Welcome back to our study of Proverbs. I hope it's been enriching. I hope it's been enlightening and has built up your faith. Last time, we started on the section that is comprised of chapters 8 and 9. 8 and 9 together constitute another unique section as we go forward through the book. And we just got started in 8, and we did look at five things that Solomon is communicating in chapter 8. And those five things were: 1, that wisdom is accessible; 2, that wisdom is not common; 3, he's exhorting to seek and value wisdom; and then number 4 is he reminds the reader that wisdom is how godly leaders function. It's kind of the secret of godly leaders. And then fifthly, Solomon describes the world as being created by wisdom, that wisdom was the tool that God used to create the world. And that's as good a segue into our lesson today as could be. And that is, I want to spend some time, and what we'll do here is look at why this chapter has been regarded as one of the most precious texts in the Bible, and certainly within the book of Proverbs, and why, at the same time, it has had some controversy. In fact, quite a bit of controversy, even way back to the 4th century and continuing until now. And so we'll look at that. And let's go ahead and start. Chapter 8 begins, "Does not wisdom call, and understanding lift up her voice?" Now, what we have, of course, is personification, which thus far we've seen several examples of that. Solomon has used this technique, this tool, personification, to make the subject, wisdom, which is kind of hard to think of, kind of hard to grasp, not well understood, he's trying to make it more accessible. You know, bring the fruit down to the low-hanging branches, as we could say, and make it personable, make it approachable, make it desirable. And he continues doing that. And this chapter, probably the most. But we see that wisdom is calling. Now, this is good to keep in mind, because as we continue, we need to remember, we need to keep in mind that Solomon is characterizing wisdom as saying the things that are going to be said. All right, so let's start with that. So let's jump down to verse 11. "Wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare with her." So you see, he's personifying wisdom, and he's personifying wisdom as a woman. Now, we begin at 12, looking at what wisdom is saying, and I want to read through 31. So let's jump in, and we got a little bit of reading to do. So 12 through 31. "I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance and the evil way, and the perverted mouth I hate. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. Power is mine. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, all who judge rightly. I love those who love me, and those who diligently seek me will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, even pure gold, and my yield than choicest silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, in the midst of the paths of justice, to endow those who love me with wealth, that I may fill their treasuries. Do we notice how many times he's mentioned loving wisdom? He does it again at the end of the chapter. Now, this next section, verse 22, we've already gone over and unpacked the verses we've read so far, but now we're getting into some new territory. And this next section, 22 through 31, is where the controversy lay. And I want to first just read it and get the sense, and then we'll parse it out. Verse 22. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While he had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he inscribed a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above, and the springs of the deep became fixed. When he set for the sea its boundaries, that the water should not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him as a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in the world, his earth, and having my delight in the sons of men. So we have Solomon characterizing wisdom as a person, and that person is a woman. But and we've seen a little bit about personification in previous lessons, but also just now as we read the first 21 verses. But now, beginning with verse 22, he's no longer focusing on the fact that he's no longer portraying wisdom as a woman particularly, but he's still sticking with personification, and he's doing it in a little different way. Now he's saying that wisdom, he's making the case for how wonderful wisdom is, and he's saying that wisdom is so great. Wisdom is so magnificent. It is so huge. It is so powerful. It is so godlike, you know, it is so much an attribute of God that God actually used it to create the world. There are some studies, in fact, some commentaries of the book of Proverbs that are actually titled The Wisdom That Created the World. And that is best borne out in this chapter right here, chapter 8. So Solomon is saying, wisdom is so wonderful, and I want you to be attracted to it, and I want you to regard it, and I want you to know it, and I want you to love it, and I want you to want it. He says, consider the fact that wisdom actually created the universe. That's what he's saying. God, through wisdom, created the cosmos. You know, as a tool. He applied wisdom in creation. He exercised wisdom. Wisdom was the method. Wisdom was the pattern. Wisdom was the tool he used. That's the first lesson we get from this. That's the very first lesson as we read this that we can get. But there are more. In fact, there's one other very significant lesson from this. And I think that we will start to understand that by backing up a little bit and considering again what personification is. What is personification? Well, of course, personification is causing the inanimate to be regarded as animate. Okay, that's the very beginning of personification. Don't we do that? We give animal or human names and characteristics to objects. you know, the Pillsbury Doughboy and you know, the gecko, the insurance company's, you know, talking gecko. That's just the beginning. What this does is it brings to the subject an emotional link, makes it relatable, elevates its importance. But we can actually take it a step further, can't we? And we can, you know, that we often name wings of hospitals and ships and boats and whatever, sometimes animal, sometimes human names, don't we? Particularly in the case of, you know, buildings and hospitals and so forth, don't we? We give them names of individuals. And then we can go a little deeper and consider that sometimes those names of human individuals are woman names, they're feminine names. And of course, this is an ancient practice, isn't it? In fact, how many times have you heard someone say, "Got her done," you know, or "She's ready," or, you know, speaking of, you know, a car or a house or, you know, isn't that interesting? I mean, we don't think about it, we just do it. And that's another level of personification. Westerners ourselves have done that, and also it's been done in the East. And both sides of the world actually have a long history of this. The Greeks, that example would be, of course, the word Sophia. You know, and even today, many families name their daughters Sophia. And that word actually comes from a Greek goddess. And that Greek goddess was the goddess of wisdom. And so to the Greeks, they personified wisdom as a she and as a goddess. We get the word, you know, sophistication. Lots of, even the word philosophy comes from that word, Sophia. The Jews, their equivalent was Shakmat, and its personification of wisdom in a woman. But the difference there was, of course, the Jews did not make her a goddess. But again, this makes wisdom, when you personify wisdom as an actual person and then even to the point of a woman, you're making it communicatable, you're making it less mysterious, you're making it more attractive and more approachable. That's well understood. You can even take chapter 8, verses 22 through 31, and you can make them personify all the way to Jesus Christ. And many people have done that. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. That's appropriate. But you need to know some difficulties. There are some difficulties when you do that. And the primary difficulty in applying Jesus to this section of Proverbs 8 in an analogous way happens when you look at verses 24 and 25. Let me read that. "When there were no depths I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth." So twice, wisdom says that it was brought forth. It appeared. It came onto the scene. Well, the difficulty here is that Bible students and theologians have pointed out the word there, or the phrase "brought forth," we have "brought forth" in verse 24 and "brought forth" in verse 25. That phrase comes from the Hebrew word "born," and that's a difficulty. Because we cannot characterize Jesus Christ as having been created. And that's what some want to do with this text. There are religious groups today that actually use this as a proof text. So it becomes an issue because of that. In fact, the very earliest incidence of someone regarding Jesus Christ as a created being, promoting that, was way back in the 4th century. And there was a man by the name of Arius. And Arius actually believed that Jesus Christ was a created being that is equal to, you know, angels and man, you know, something created. But of course, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you cannot believe he was created, because that destroys the gospel. The gospel cannot consist. The gospel cannot without Jesus Christ being the Son of God. And if he's not, if he's not eternal, equal with God in all respects. Let me read you that. Hebrews chapter 1 says that Jesus is the radiance of God's glory, verse 3. The radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. Did you get that? So some versions have brought forth here. Some versions have born. And it's legitimate that you can translate the word there that's translated brought forth in the NAS and the ESV. It's legitimate to render it born. And in fact, there are some places where that actually happens elsewhere in Scripture. Let me give you some examples. The Hebrew meaning in English of the root, you know, the earliest use of the word, the root origin of the Hebrew word, is to writhe, you know, to squirm, to writhe. And of course, that's a very emotional word. And it's often used to mean drama, pain, childbirth, ecstasy, and worship. For example, in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 23, it says there, "The north wind brings forth rain, and a backbiting tongue, an angry countenance." Brings forth rain. That's the same Hebrew word. So brings forth. Do you see? Psalm 29, verse 9, you will have mention of deer calving. You know, deer calving, giving birth. Deer giving birth to deer. And that's the same Hebrew word. So it can be translated as born, bringing forth, that sort of thing. But you have to remember that language is very contextual. Even in English, today I hit the bottle, interpret that as you're drinking. But what if you were hitting the ketchup bottle? I mean, this is a silly example, but you get it. You get the idea that English, and really any language, has contextual implication. You have to remember the context. Well, it's the same thing with Hebrew and Greek. It's the same thing. And what we have here is we have different applications and different meanings depending on how it's used. So what's happening here in chapter 8? What's happening is wisdom, when it says it's brought forth or delivered or calved or, you know, it appears on the scene, what it's saying is that it was debuted. It was a debutante, all right, in modern lingo. Wisdom is calling itself a debutante. It's saying that wisdom made itself known. Wisdom was revealed for the very first time in creation. That's all it's saying. Now, can we still find Jesus Christ in this section, verses 22 through 31? Yes, we can. Look at verse 23. From everlasting I was established. From the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. Now, does that sound to you like someone who has been created? So even in the text itself, if you do find Jesus in the text, and you can use the analogy of Jesus in the text. But look at the text itself. Even the text itself says eternal. Let me read it again. Verse 23. From everlasting I was established. From the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. So wisdom is saying it had no beginning, just like God, just like Jesus Christ. And of course, there are many places where Jesus is spoken of in the New Testament as having no beginning. If we go to John, the very first verse of the Gospel of John says that Jesus was in the beginning. If you look at Jesus describing himself in chapter 8 of John, he calls himself the I Am. And the Jews then, and the Jews today, interpret that as the eternal one. And then if you go to Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 7, you have the writer of Hebrews, which many think was Paul, and I think was Paul, is describing, among other things, Jesus is analogous to a certain individual. Chapter 7, we have an analogy of Jesus Christ to a historical figure named Melchizedek or Melchizedek. Melchizedek was kind of famous during his time because he was so old and people around him were kind of marveling, and what they regarded him as a person who had no ancestors. Now that is not possible, is not so, but that's the way they regarded him because of his old age and his wisdom. And he was often thought of back then, and the writer of Hebrews brings this up, as having no genealogy, having no history. And the writer of Hebrews is taking, you know, what was sort of a custom, sort of an understanding in that time, and applying that in an analogy way to Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ is eternal. So we have lots and lots of support for the traditional Christian view of Jesus not being created, but being God Himself, the second person of the threefold Godhead, and not created, not. Now let's just look at this passage and think about what this means. We've already seen that the meaning to the readers in that time that it was written was simply that wisdom is so wonderful that it actually coincided, or its debut, let's say, coincided and paralleled creation, and in fact was responsible for creation. That's the message of these verses. That's the primary message. Now, can we apply this to Jesus Christ? We certainly can. But if we do, we have to remember that verse 24 and verse 25 should not be, we should not stumble over them, but understand them in their contextual meaning and in their actual meaning. Now, this is really a great thing. And what it's describing here is creation's power. Creation's power, and the very power of creation is found in Jesus Christ. Not only is he the power of creation, and we see that in verse, back to Proverbs chapter 8, we see that not only do we see the power of creation, we're going to see something else also, but the power of creation is visible in the beginning of the chapter, chapter 8 of Proverbs. We see this, we see verse 12, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. Verse 14, counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. Power is mine. There's the very word. So the power of creation, the debut of creation, the magnificence of creation is wisdom. Wisdom created it. Wisdom is how creation can be characterized, and wisdom defines the power of creation. But we're also justified in seeing the agent of creation in this passage, and we've already discussed that, the fact that if you want to find Jesus Christ in this chapter, you can do that. In verses 22 through 31, you can certainly do that. And it is justified. Let's jump down to 30, verse 30. When I was beside him as a master workman, and I was daily his delight. A master workman. Well, hold your finger there and jump over to John chapter 1. And let's look at something that the Apostle John says about Jesus Christ. John chapter 1, verse 3, all things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. We can also go to Colossians. That's the book that Paul wrote to the church in Colossae. It was a Roman colony. And we look at Colossians chapter 1, and we find the same thing. Chapter 1, verse 16. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created by him and, there it is again, for him. This is some of the richness of this chapter. This is some of the marvelousness of this chapter. We do well to meditate on that. Let me read that section again. Verse 22. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. When there were no depths I was brought forth, when there was no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth. When he had not made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he inscribed a circle on the face of the deep. When he made the firm skies above. When the springs of the deep became fixed. When he set for the sea its boundaries, that the water should not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundation of the earth. Then I was beside him as a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in the world, his earth, and having my delight in the sons of men. What we have here is Jesus being the superintendent of creation. Master workman, you see. Verse 30. That's a neat thing. As the New Testament tells us, Jesus did create the world. Did you know, by the way, that Jesus Christ also led the Jews out of Egypt, according to the New Testament book of Jude? Yeah, it says Jesus led the Jews out of Egypt. Well, so there's a lot of neat stuff there in that chapter. Let's go ahead and finish it up. Verse 32. Now therefore, O sons, listen to me, for blessed are they who keep my ways. Heed instruction and be wise, and do not neglect it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts. For he who finds me finds life, and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me injures himself. All those who hate me love death. You know what? Even in this section, this little tail end of the chapter, the last couple of verses, for he who finds me finds life and obtains favor, and he who sins against me injures himself, and those who hate me love death. You could definitely attribute gospel implications to that section as well. Certainly. I want to go to chapter 9, but look at verse 1. Wisdom has built her house and has hewn out her seven pillars. She's prepared her food, she's mixed her wine, she's also set her table. She has sent out her maidens, she calls, from the tops of the heights of the city. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. To him who lacks understanding, she says, come eat of my food and drink of the wine that I have mixed. Let's back up. Verse 4. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. So this is wisdom speaking, again, personification. And Solomon will continue in chapter 9 until he gets to verse 13, and then he changes horses, so to speak, or literally women. Now he has a woman again, but this is a different woman. Verse 13, the woman of folly is boisterous. She is naive and knows nothing. She sits at the doorway of her house and by the seat of the high places, calling to those who pass by, who are making their path straight. Look what she says, verse 16. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. The exact same thing that wisdom personified as a woman is saying in verse 4. So verse 4 and verse 16. What do we have here? We have two voices. We have two voices calling out to passersby. And notice, as this text describes passersby, it's talking about, you know, it says the heights of the city and the corners and all that. In other words, everyone has access to this choice. Everyone has access to either choose wisdom or choose folly. Foolishness, we would say today. Choose wisdom or choose not wisdom. And that's what's going on here in chapter 9 especially. The two voices that are calling out. And everyone has these two voices. Everyone has access to wisdom and to foolishness. And everyone has the choice. That's why it's described in the exact same words in both cases. The tops of the heights of the city calling out whoever. Look, it says 14 says the high places. And 3 says the heights of the city. Do you see the most traveled, the most busy, the most populous, the most foot-worn places, that's where wisdom and that's where foolishness is trying to attract people. And Solomon is wise enough to know this. And he says, you have a choice. You know, believing in the gospel of Jesus Christ, it's not a matter of information. Those who spurn Jesus, they're not doing so because they lack information. No one who either chooses or chooses against Jesus Christ does so because they don't have enough data. That's not what's being described here. What's being described is just plain choice of the heart. And notice that they're both naive. Verse 4 and verse 16, they're both naive. You may recall from the earlier lessons, the naive person, remember we have the wise, who's described in Proverbs, defined in Proverbs as being the one who chooses God. The fool, who's described in Proverbs as the one who chooses against God. And the naive, who doesn't feel there's a need for a choice. He's comfort where he is. He's complacent. That's the individual that these two voices are after. They're after the guy who's still impressionable. They're after the one who is deceivable, who is gullible, who is not very smart, and is complacent, and is comfortable, and he's happy where he is. So the two voices calling out is how we end this section. And I hope you got some insight, and I hope you got some encouragement. What we'll do the next time is we will move into the bulk of the book of Proverbs, the middle section of the book, which actually is the bulk of it, chapters 10 through 29. And that's where it's easy to get a little bit bogged down. So we'll try to change things up, make it a little more interesting, kind of change the pace. But for now, just realize we've covered 9 chapters now, chapters 1 through 9. And what we've seen is chapter 1, the young man who's still in the home. Chapter 2, the young man who's just left the home. Chapter 3, the young man who's making his way in the world in terms of his career and so forth. Chapter 4, the young man who's just gotten married and is now a father. And then chapter 5 through 7, chapters 5 through 7, together make up the fifth young man group, who was, we saw last time, or the lesson before the last, who was the one who's been married for a while, he's been in his job for a while, he's had his home for a while, he's established, he has the resources, which in both time and money, to have leisure. And with that leisure comes certain temptations. Boredom and wanting to reach out and do things maybe he shouldn't be doing. And we looked at that already, and we saw that the number one thing in chapters 5 through 7 was sex. And then we saw how he uses his money. And then we saw how he has chances to either protect or damage his character. So sex, money, and character was the theme of 5 through 7. And then when we get into 8 and 9, as we've just seen, we have Solomon really speaking to all 5 groups. Solomon's speaking to all 5 groups now in chapters 8 and 9, and really making the case for wisdom. He's making his final plea, his summary pleas to the 5 groups. And before he signs off to that particular segment of society, and then goes into just general advice and general instruction. So I hope you understand, hope you can visualize this, and it helps you see how the book of Proverbs plays out. So next time, we will do something a little different. We will look at some better than verses. Better than. There are a number of verses in Proverbs which are designed with contrast. Solomon says, this is better than this. This is better than this. This is better than this. He does that a lot of times, and we'll look at those as a topic, and we'll unpack those and see the wisdom of Solomon. Thank you for being with me on this and in this journey, and until next time, believe God.